It is July 6th, 2017, and we are here with Andy and Professor Joseph talking about Zambia.
All right, very good. So I'm so glad. It seems like it's taken us forever to get to Zambia. Zambia, it's really unfortunate, recent developments in Zambia, but I'm still hopeful because I've seen Zambia pull out of some downturns ever since the 1991 elections. But the Zambian experience is a very warming experience for me. I haven't had much involvement in Zambia. Most of my work has been in West Africa, elsewhere, Sudan and so on. I really liked the Zambian people. It was just a very, very positive experience. So let me just do a little bit of framing of it. The first is that the transition from single-party rule to a multi-party system in Zambia, I consider one of the really significant achievements of that era, and for a variety of reasons. The first one is that it was a peaceful process, which is hugely important. The second one is because of Kenneth Kaunda himself. He was a leader, one of the leaders of the nationalist independence era in Africa. He was a man who was really highly respected across Africa. He portrayed himself as a democratic socialist, in other words, with a very strong orientation to social programs, to social progress. There was also a religious aspect to his public persona, to his political life. He also had this emotional side to him, which in fact he used to have these huge handkerchiefs he would carry, and then he would get very emotional. It almost seems almost on cue he would start dabbing his eyes. After a while, it became sort of just part of who he was. But anyway, he was I really personally liked Kenneth Kaunda, which I cannot say for a number of leaders. You had to deal with them and everything else. They were ruthless. Some of them were worse than ruthless, but he was just a person with just a lot of charm, and in a lot of ways. And he treated me in terms of, I had a lot of interactions with him in a very respectful way. So, but Zambia, and this is another dimension about the Zambia program that I'm, mentioned, and it's one of the cases where we didn't do, as much as, I would like to do, and it wasn't as much a part of the whole program. Things were happening very rapidly. But it was the idea of associating some kind of an economic development project, some kind of economic development program to these transition exercises, right? Because a lot of the transitions, they were spurred by the failing model, the political economy model in much of post-independence Africa, by that time, by the late 80s, they were not working. These countries were becoming increasingly indebted. You know, the level of private entrepreneurship was dropping, and so on. There were just a lot of deficits, and of course, a lot of them were being propped up by, you know, by aid and loan systems. And Zambia was one of those cases. Zambia went from being one of the countries that was seen as having these great, great prospects economically, and which had fallen on very hard times. Of course, some of it was related to the copper industry, which had come to really dominate the economy. And, you know, with those countries, when you rely greatly on a particular mineral export, then, you know, as world prices drop, you know, that affects everything altogether. And then so much about the system, you know, had not been working under Kaunda. So one aspect, you know, and I was, when we were talking about Ghana, I was contrasting it with Zambia. But in the case of Zambia, you were entering a situation of a country that was, you know, was really weak and weakening. And as there was a lot of pressure to move to pluralist systems, right, to remove a lot of the, you know, the impediments, the legal and other impediments, Zambia was a country that didn't have many means of resisting that wave. Now, another dimension about Zambia, you know, from our engagement, you know, and I, you know, we were talking recently about Togo and the question of thinking of our role, this is the Carter Center role in terms of intervening to move a process forward. In the case of Zambia, the degree of Zambian dependence on external aid and assistance, and the long-term commitment, when I say long-term, I'm remembering even from earlier times in my career, you know, for example, 1975-76, when I was a visiting scholar at the Institute for Development Studies in Sussex, England, and just remembering the economists at IDS, the name of the institute, who were very much involved with Zambia and very much involved in, you know, in development planning in Zambia. So Zambia really, you know, had basically tried and failed. Okay, so, and the reason I'm saying that is I'm remembering very clearly the it was a Scandinavian, I'll have to, you know, check my notes to see which Scandinavian country, and it could have been Sweden, but, you know, I can't remember which one exactly. But it was one of the Scandinavian embassies where the ambassador was dean of the diplomatic corps in Zambia, right? And so the engagement of these external organizations in Zambia was done in a coordinated fashion. So there would be meetings convened by that ambassador, and you would have various representatives there. There'd be representatives of particular countries, and there'd be representatives of the Carter Center and other independent organizations. And it was really there was a very strong cooperative spirit to what was going on, right? And again, I really want to emphasize that, because as we're doing a lot of these cross-cutting, you know, some of the cases were, you know, confrontational, you know. Jerry Rawlings was only going to give, you know, as much as he was forced to give, right? So what happened was, you now had now the emergence of these opposition groups, Kaunda backing down as the pressure built up. And you can see all the different stages, you know, resisting multipartyism, conceding to multipartyism, all of the different concessions, and the record will be there to show it. But the story was one of Kaunda not, you know, trying to home for and having to give ground, you know, progressively. And so we're there in this process now. And we are, so we are part of the process, but we are not sort of, we didn't have to be spearheading it. Now, let me get on to President Carter here, because one dimension of his role during this period was where there were leaders that he knew when he was president. So he had leaders that he'd worked with as president of the United States, and Kaunda would have been one of those. And so there will be already a history of a relationship there. You know, and sometimes the relationship was okay. Sometimes, you know, the relationship, such as Mugabe, was not okay, was not good. Other cases like Rawlings, you know, these were new people on the scene, you know, that he had a personal attachment to, because he liked these dynamic, you know, figures, you know. He Carter. One of the things about Jimmy Carter, since it's part of what we're doing, is Jimmy Carter had a very strong sense of Jimmy Carter, right? You know, and therefore part of Jimmy Carter was that, traditional politicians, people who were not really much about, you know, really doing things, getting things done, were people that he did not have a high regard for. He really had high regard for people who, if he felt, you know, were people who either were doing something or the people with whom something positive could be done, right? Getting to Kaunda arriving in Lusaka, one of the missions ahead of President Carter, and this was when we were getting close to the elections. And obviously within the, the governing party in Zambia, there were those who were very much resistant to Kaunda giving ground. So Kaunda did not have, he didn't have a united group of people. You know, they were responding in different ways to the pressure. But I know that there was, and I can't remember the names of some of the people now, but it was significant people, and we were interacting with them. And they were very clear that they were very displeased with not only, you know, the political pressures building up, but also displeased with Kaunda giving ground to it. But anyway, I remember this one occasion when we arrived, and there was, and this is when, you know, agreement had been reached in terms of how the process was going. But it was a very strong letter that was published in the newspapers, criticizing these external actors, right, and including the Carter Center. And I remember drafting a statement on behalf of the Carter Center, responding to it, I remember President Carter arrived, and I had already drafted the statement that would be issued, by the Carter Center. And I remember showing it to him and, you know, just having him read through the statement and response to it, and then, you know, handing it back to me and saying, okay, you know. So it was just to give you an idea of the degree of trust that had built up, and, you know, and the ability to really articulate where we stood on some of these, these kinds of issues, you know, where they were pushback. And it was interesting seeing, you know, how Carter was responding in these contexts, because he wasn't surprised, you know, that this would be happening, and even that Kaunda would be saying one thing, and then his party or someone would be issuing a statement that would be completely contrary to what he's saying. He just understood these dilemmas. You'll be able to read about how the elections went through, you know, the movement for multi-party democracy. Another important feature about Zambia were, and again, you know, we were meeting with this wide range of And that was another thing about the Zambian process. There was just a lot of cooperation. There was cooperation in terms of the international community, right? And with the Scandinavian in the lead, because they had invested a lot over the years in Zambia. And there was a very cooperative spirit among the opposition groups, right? The political opposition groups, you know, NGO-type groups, human rights groups. But a very important role was played by the church groups. I mean, I could, you know, I could just, I don't, can't call the names offhand, but I could see their faces in front of me of, you know, these church leaders who played a very, very significant role in that process. And remember, you know, Kaunda also was a very church-going man. Religion was really part of his. So here you had, you know, with the religious groups very much going in favor of the opposition. So, you know, with we're going to be able to talk a little bit more about what happened after the election. Of course, I'll always remember standing there as the, you know, the elections, the, you know, the ballots are coming in, ballot boxes, you know, coming into the counting halls. And, you know, I have some pictures of it. Some of them we've actually published on Africa Plus. I remember that, you know, with the, because, you know, we would look into all different aspects of the process. And, for example, well, where the ballot's going to be counted, right? The preference is to have ballots counted at the polling booth, right? Counted there at the polling booth for the numbers to be, you know, posted and so on. You know, just ways of avoiding fraud. But it, and there's some, you know, cases where you're able to make changes, but in some cases, especially, you know, during the time, you know, spans we're dealing with, where you were not able to make a lot of these changes. In the case of Zambia, I remember that, you know, they had, that the counting was going to take place at these collection sites. Mm-hmm. Now, so then there's concern about what happens when you're moving ballot boxes, right? But I always remember this incredible sight. I mean, sometimes, you know, the sight of, you know, seeing people lining up and, you know, seeing what, you know, I mean, in the U.S. here, we get a very low voting, people voting, and they make voting so easy for us. I mean, voting in America is like going to the post office, right? You know, it might be a line of a certain length or not, but that's about it. You go in there and, it, you know, you're in and out, right? 5-10 minutes at the most, right? But, you know, seeing people go in and lining up, you know, all day long, I mean, it's really, you know, to cast their votes and to make that possible. But anyway, one, two sort of indelible memories from Zambia with the counting was seeing, you know, one hall where the ballot papers, you know, ballot boxes had been brought, and the ballot boxes were there, and seeing people actually going and sitting around the ballot boxes. In other words, they were going to stay there and, you know, watch those ballot boxes physically, you know, to make sure. I mean, it was, all right, we're trying to find ways of protecting it, but here these people, I mean, it was just an incredible sight, you know. You almost feel like you want to make a videotape. People can say, you can see what your vote means, that people are willing to come and sit here, you know, overnight to make sure nobody tampers with the ballot boxes. The other one was, because this, in, we also did this together with National Democratic Institute, and, you know, as time goes on, there'll be a lot more I'll be able to pull out from my memory about the experience there. But one was when we were planning what is called a parallel vote count. Now, this is something that's done very often now. It has become very, you know, systematic and scientific, these parallel vote count, you know, where they work out mathematically, you know, what kind of proportion of the, you know, of the actual voting results they needed to get the results of, to be able to make projections. And that way they can tell, you know, to what extent. It's just a way of being able to, kind of a check, a verifying what is going on, right? But I always remember when we were all standing there, and in fact there's even a picture, I think, on Africa Plus, and it shows Brian Atwood, who was then the head of NDI, Mrs. Carter, who was always in the mix of all of this, President Carter, myself, and so on. And we're watching, as the ballot, as the counting is going on, you know, after these and I always remember there's a moment in which Brian Atwood, you know, said to me or to others, I don't think we're going to need any parallel voting process, because the votes, it was going to be a landslide victory. You know, you're just standing here and you're just seeing it. And it was an incredible moment. And I think this was as far as I'm aware, the first defeat during this era of what you would call, consider a major African leader, I mean, with a national, international reputation, and with a party that had been entrenched in power for many years, and to find it, two-thirds or so of the vote, going to the opposition. So that was very impressive. But let me just use this moment to just say something about Ghana in that regard, in terms of, the processes, because there are times in which, if you could just think what we just talked about, we talked about Togo. Here is Togo, a situation where the Carter Center didn't even want to be around physically in the country. So they didn't want to be at all associated with the vote, right? Because it had not been able to get all the guarantees and so on, right? So that's one case. And then you get Zambia, in which, again, a lot of the pre-electoral pressures and so on had been put in place. And there were a lot of them, and we would get very detailed. We'll prepare these, and NDI does it, now it's very systematic. We'll do these pre-election reports. And those pre-election reports would be, go down to such detail. Sometimes get into real fine grain. It'll be, monitoring, because in most of these cases you had, one radio station or television station, monitoring the television station, radio station, to see to what extent the opposition had free access to it, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, and these are things that when you're dealing with these regimes, it's not like they're just kind of verbally saying, okay, sure, we'll give them free access, but then you go and monitor it. And then you can come to them and say, hey, wait a second, we monitor it for these days, and this is the position itself. Right? Okay, but so I'm just saying that to show how, and I just want to say something in case of Ghana, as part of our thinking, cross nationally, some of these things. I'll always remember in Ghana when the elections results were coming in, Rawlings, they had split elections. It was going to be just the presidential election at the time before the legislative election, and it was very much, going in the direction of Rawlings, and the opposition was, talking about, of all the abuse and everything else, and, they published a report, stolen victory, and so on the elections. But I always remember there was a moment now when I don't want to name the organization that was involved, since anytime I have to name other organizations, I'd be a little concerned here. But we had another organization that was involved in the monitoring process that was conducting a parallel vote tabulation. And I always remember that moment. This became a very critical moment now, where the opposition was just not willing to go ahead with the process, where the regime was really digging in really hard, right? And I remember that person coming to me and saying to me, we have some indications from the parallel vote count that we were doing, and those parallel vote counts show that how fraudulent the official figures are, right? And at that moment, it was a moment of, and I made that decision. On the spot, I made that decision that, this is very tense here. The situation is very tense here. We want them, because we're going to have legislative elections and so on. The opposition was saying they're going to boycott the elections, and I was trying to find a way. President Carter wasn't there. We had no other senior person there. So I was in that position of doing that. But I remember saying, let's just not bother with that. because I thought that was, you know, that was just going to be adding, you know, fuel to the store. What was inside, you know, in fact, a quite tense situation. Okay, so I'm just saying that to give you the contrast, because here in Zambia, that was not the case. Everything had taken place. The regime was still fully in control, and the people had been able to vote, and it was clear, you know, the opposition going to leave. And then the last thing again was, and again here about the role of President Carter, one of his important contributions to these processes. In fact, I just received a message back from the Carter Center, because, you know, I'm still in communication with them, because I'm hoping that, you know, even if we can't get to see Carter himself, we can have a meeting with the current folks at the Carter Center, because they have a whole slew of things they're doing. And to be able to now talk to them about the work that we did, it could be a very interesting conversation, because this is their business. I mean, you know, there are people there who've been doing this for ever since I left there. But another important role that he played, and it also played, probably also came into effect in Zambia. And this is, even if the ruling party is defeated an election, there is no guarantee that it's going to respect that, that it's going to accept the defeat. Mm-hmm. And Carter himself, and he always says that, you know, I've lost an election, I know what it's like. And he always would use that, you know, and it's sort of, you know, he had little phrases you would use, you know, there's life afterwards and so on and everything else. But Carter, knowing that, prior to the vote, would work to get commitments that all the contestants would accept the results. And, you know, of course, he's doing that in the sense of working a lot with the opposition and everything else, that they will accept it. But, you know, Carter believed, and he says that. He says, you know, nobody expects you're going to lose an election. And again, he would use his own case. And so, it's very important that at that time, when they're still thinking, you know, all right, we have an election, there's no way, I'm a popular person, I've been here, the people love me, and so on. So Kaunda conceding defeat, and we don't think of it any, well, I guess we still do think of it, because it still come up in some instances. But at the time, losing an election mean they said, you know, something was wrong, there was fraudulent, there was this, that, and the other. I mean, look at our own country, right? Mm-hmm. You start, you know, that so-and-so and everything else, and, they'll find any kind of reasons not to do that. Now, if look at what happened in Kenya in 2007, 2008, is where the election took place. You know, the government was losing the election, right? And, you know, they decide, you know, they were not going to accept it. They put pressure on the election commission to start, changing the figures and so on. And then you had eruption in the country. 1,000 people lost their lives. So very important that, you know, at that point in time that Kaunda, just graciously accepted the defeat. Mm-hmm. And so Zambia was really also very important for really sending that message, that you can lose, and not only you can lose, you can concede. So, yeah. Like I said, yeah, Zambia is for me, you know, a really wonderful story. So, over to you. You got a few questions?
Yeah, so I was just wondering, I mean, everywhere you look, if you read like newspaper articles, you just hear you talk about Agouti saying 1991 elections is just a huge landmark for Africa in general, and really kind of setting the pace of how things should go. And then it wasn't too long before that really started to crumble.
Right.
And I'm wondering what role you think the fact that Kaunda, he did concede that election, but he didn't retire from politics after that, and he was still wanting to run in the next elections, still with the same party and things like that. I was wondering what role you think that played in kind of the fall of the ideal situation.
No, I wouldn't hold Kaunda responsible. Kaunda still, I mean, I don't know what his age was then, but, I mean, he still did not see himself as this sort of you know, elderly person who's going to move on to... I'll tell you an interesting conversation I had at the time that really bears on this in terms of Kaundu himself personally. This is a conversation I had with then General Obasanjo, who'd been the military head of government in Nigeria, then came back as a civilian president. But during this interim period, and I remember, so this would have been a conversation that took place right around the time of the 91 elections. And we got into talking, you know, about it, and we were talking about Zambia. And Obasanjo said to me, and let me try to recollect exactly the nature of the conversation. He either said to me that this he was relaying a conversation he had with Kaunda, or a conversation he would like to have in Kaunda. I can't remember right now which of the two, but the essence of the conversation, and I remember him, the familiar terms which he was saying it. He was saying, so I did say, or I would like to say to Ken, I mean, he refers to him as Ken, I'm feeling lonely, you know, because at that time, Obasanjo was organizing these this Africa Leadership Forum, and you know, so, and he was saying, you know, about wanting to say to Kaunda, you know, leave that politics aside, come and join me. I could, you know, I could use your help in terms of that process, right? But, you know, but Kaunda was still seeing himself as this political, you know, fighter. I mean, at one point in his campaigning, you know, facing a lot of opposition from, you know, Chiluba was a trade union leader and so on. He started wearing this American-type flight jacket. you know, I mean, if you look, think of how Kaunda normally would dress, right? And all of a sudden he's appearing on a podium wearing this American-type flight jacket as a way of... I mean, it was just...
A little different.
A little sad. What?
He still have his handkerchief with him?
No. His handkerchief was used in different moments. He'd whip it out and start sobbing and everything else. He was a great guy. But anyway, get back to your question. No, I didn't think it was... The fact that Kaunda, you know, hung around, was looking to run again, you know, had not really, you know, wasn't ready to step off the stage... You know, well, I don't know. I mean, I don't have any, you know, I mean, it would be great if he thought differently, but that's not the case. Obasanjo didn't think differently. He came back in and ran for president, right? No, I think it was Chiluba that, and not, you know, and, you know, I don't want to get too far in, because this is a very important question of what happened. Yeah. But Chiluba, you know, really, he was this really brilliant orator, you know, he was, you referred to him as a tribune of the people, he had been a long-time labor leader, so he had great skills, very charismatic. I mean, he was a little guy, he had to wear these platform shoes, I remember, he was just a little guy, but he was, but once he got into power, it was like a different guy. It was like, yeah. Where was this guy who was competing for power? I mean, in no time at all, Chiluba, now all the things that you would normally associate that you're fighting against in terms of some of these rulers, in no time at all, Chiluba looks like he was just adopting all the things that supposedly he fought against.
Like he really fought for the whole, you know, multi-party democracy. And then I guess the reason I was wondering, you know, what role Kaunda staying in politics had in kind of the fall from free elections, is that, you know, Chiluba passed this thing, I don't remember what year, a few years later, effectively barring Kaunda from running again, saying it was something like your parents had to be born in Zambia or something like that.
Yeah.
And I don't know how much of that was he wanted to run himself, or he didn't want Kaunda to have a chance to come back into power.
No, but I, on the one hand, I'm seeing that somebody who is able to dislodge somebody who's been there as long as Kaunda was, and then, of course, there's a certain amount of personal animus,
right,
you know, that develops and so on. All right, so I could understand that that person comes in now, wants to really lock the door on any kind of opposition, right? But what I'm saying to you is that Chiluba coming to power with the broad base of support that he had. Remember, he had the trade union movement, yeah, which was one of the strongest in Africa. He had that movement. Huge amount of international support. Because all of these organizations I told you that were funding a lot of these actions, and they were very glad. They were glad to see Kaunda go. They considered that this, because, you know, the government had gone through a lot of different economic reforms.
Right.
Kaunda came to be seen, and most likely correctly, as just being incompetent, mm-hmm, in financial matters, right?
And he had all the control over all the financial matters.
Right, he did. But by that time, they had lost faith in him. So they were really glad to see, you know, Chiluba coming in, the whole, you know, alliance he had. So the fact that Kaunda was there and still trying to come back, Kaunda was trying to come back via the system that had been put in place. I mean, he wasn't doing anything, you know, illegal or outside of those bounds. But it was really, it was really Chiluba. Chiluba, you know, the nature of the Chiluba personality. And I don't want to go into it now, but I'll talk to you about, a trip I made to Zambia just to find out what was going on and why. Why in such a short period of time, what happens? And, you know, so I had conversation with a lot of people. And then they told me then, and it became more and more demonstrated as time went on, that it was Chiluba. Chiluba came in, and everything that we were seeing, And another point that's coming out from a lot of these interviews that we're having here is I'm realizing, you know, how much the sort of leadership factor matters, you know? How much these particular individuals matter, their personalities matter, mm-hmm, so
on. Actually, in one of the books I was reading, he cited, I don't remember who wrote it originally, I have it in here somewhere, that in Zambia, at least in the early 90s, these political parties that were really forming didn't revolve as much around a certain ideology, but more around the leader that was the head of the party and his kind of charisma. I don't know what you think about that perspective.
All right. Okay, well, we'll make this the last question today, yeah, but in the case, again, remember, you know, I really, you know, we want to see these rulers, and in the case of Kaunda, to think of where they were. So Kaunda coming to power, remember, he's coming to power in the whole struggle with Northern Rhodesia and with Southern Rhodesia, right? Mm-hmm. The whole fact of the whole settler movement, you know, the attempt to create the Central African Federation, largely to block, you know, the African nationalist movements, right? And then the emergence separately of Malawi, and then of Zambia. And then finally, the struggles, in Rhodesia, leading to Zimbabwe. So understand that Kaunda was really seen as a real, as a real fighter. I mean, alongside, you know, the African National Congress and others. I mean, he really had that, and genuinely. The role that he played in that independent struggle. And not just an independent struggle, it's an independent struggle against your European settler domination, which is European settlers are trying to find a way to maintain control of these territories, because they had very strong, involvement in your engagement in the agricultural mining sector and so on. And then you have also Kaunda with his very strong commitment to social democracy. And here again, Kaunda was very much paired with Julius Nyerere in Tanzania, of those who represented not just fighting for independence, but they're also fighting to change the orientation of the former colonial system so it really benefits the people. So he had a lot of that populist, social democratic, aspect to him. Mm-hmm. Over time, the move to single party systems and all the other things is where a lot of that became hollow because the government now was very much about survival. So I don't know how we got on to this, but I still think, we in thinking about the Zambia and how Zambia was able to have such a successful transition exercise. I mean, I would give a great deal of the, I'll share credit around non-governmental groups, the strength of the opposition, coherence, all of that. But I also give Kaunda part of that. I give him a considerable amount of credit also for how it went. Right? Yeah. I mean, so I've come out of this process, I have seen him, I've interacted with him, well after that. And the relationship, I haven't seen him in many years, but it was really just very, very friendly, very positive. I think at bottom, he had lost, but I think at bottom he also felt, I think he felt good about the fact that, they were able to do it, without violence and without, claims of fraud and all of that. Mm-hmm. Okay? Good.